First of all, the bright, clear colour of the sky and all that it holds within it. The stars that wander here and there, and the moon, and the radiance of the sun with its brilliant, brilliant light. All these, if now they were in a moment placed before our eyes, what story could be told more marvellous than these things? Or what that the nations would less dare to believe beforehand? Yet think how no one now, wearied with satiety of seeing, deigns to look up, to gaze up at the shining quarters of the sky. So there's some words, favourite words of mine from the ancient philosopher Lucretius. And they evoke, don't they, this sense of wonder. I find it interesting that he was speaking centuries ago, millennia ago, and he was saying that in his day, people no longer gazed up in wonder at the sky, at the heavens, at the stars, at the moon, at the sun. And if it was true then, I suspect it's a whole deal more true now. I think that's a real shame. I think that that is such a loss for us sophisticated 21st century urban dwellers. In Bethnal Green, it's you don't see much of sky at the best of times. You occasionally glimpse the moon, and then it's glorious when you do. And as for stars, well, no. There are no stars in Bethnal Green. They don't shine there. So, yes, it's this sense of wonder that I want to try and point us to, because I think it underpins everything that we've been trying to explore on this retreat. At least it does for me. And Verochena, who's appeared magnificently up there at the centre and at the top of this mandala, this beautiful mandala, this rich mandala, for me, he's perhaps the most wonderful, mysterious figure of them all. So much so that, in a way, he's not often sort of talked about. He's perhaps not even often meditated upon. Because in a sense, he's less accessible. He's more mysterious. He's there at the centre, at the heart of the mandala, though. And he's a radiant, dazzling white colour. He's made of light, as all the figures are. But in his case, it's a dazzling, radiant, brilliant white light. So much so that he's surrounded by rainbows, because it would be too much to look at him. You couldn't see him. It would be like staring at the sun. So he's surrounded by rainbows that protect us from the brilliance of his light. And he holds a golden 8-spoked wheel, and he holds it as if he's turning it. He holds this wheel as if he's turning it, and it's the wheel of the Dharma. It's the 8-spoked wheel of the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path, which is it's a classic early Buddhist teaching. And he's turning this wheel because he's teaching the Dharma. He's teaching the Dharma. To turn the wheel of the Dharma, to set it in motion, is to teach the truth, to teach reality to anybody that can has eyes to see it. So yes, this mudra, this gesture, is the teaching mudra that he makes. He's also in that image clothed in silks and jewels and all the ornaments of a prince. because they're symbols of his inner wealth, his inner richness. And he's sort of androgynous, and something of that comes up in this image. Actually, none of the Buddhas are male or female in the psychological sense. These figures happen to be male, but they all have female consorts. But in a certain sense, the enlightened mind is neither male nor female, masculine nor feminine. It transcends such dualities or dichotomies. And sometimes in the Indo-Tibetan tradition, enlightened beings are sort of androgynous. And in this figure, in this particular image, he has something of that. Something of that. So Shakyamuni Buddha, the historical Buddha that we've been hearing about, is the man, the Buddha, who first turned the wheel of the Dharma. He discovered enlightenment for the first time, and then he taught it. He taught the Dharma to all that he came into contact with, and many, many of them became realized, became enlightened. So it's said that, yes, he turned the wheel of the Dharma for the first time, which, from a Buddhist perspective, isn't just a happening that happened in ancient India, in ancient northern India, in sort of historical time, although that is true at one level. From a Buddhist perspective, it's got cosmic significance, because enlightened beings, the Buddha, is the highest possible being in the cosmos. Enlightened humanity is the highest possible expression of the cosmos. You could say that it's what the whole universe is evolving towards. And for the Buddha to emerge in the universe is of cosmic significance. And then for him to teach the Dharma is of cosmic significance. When he became enlightened, the universe shook. The whole cosmos shook. And metaphorically, that's pointing to that significance. So he first taught the Dharma, but I'm going to step back in the story to before his enlightenment to in a way illustrate how he came to first teach the Dharma. So we've heard that before he sat under the Bodhi tree, he'd for many years, for several years, tried to practice extreme asceticism. Under the mistaken thought that if you mortified the flesh, then you would free the spirit, which was a prominent belief in India of those times, and still is in India. You find sadhus doing all sorts of ascetic things. And Siddhartha Gautama, as he was then, excelled at asceticism. He seems to have excelled at anything that he did, at least according to the legend. So according to the legend, he was the best at going hungry. In fact, he was able to starve himself beyond what any other person could have endured and still practice. And because of his sort of reputation, he attracted some followers when he was an ascetic. In particular, there were five other ascetics who practiced with him, and they were all six of them trying to gain liberation, reach this liberation from the wheel of life, from suffering of samsara, from birth and death, for an answer to what it is to have human existence. They were all practicing. Siddhartha Gautama got to the point where he realized that he was about to die. He was about to die. Legend has it he'd lived on one grain of rice a day, and that he was completely skeletal. And he realized that he was going to die, and that he'd got no nearer to the truth. That if he carried on like this for any time longer, he'd die, and he'd still be no nearer the truth. And he suddenly realized that this sort of extreme mortification, this ascetic practice, was the wrong path. So he bathed in the river and he accepted some food. A woman called Sujata is credited as giving him his first proper meal, and it was rice milk. Probably he couldn't have digested very much, so it was some rice boiled in milk, and he accepted some food and regained some energy, and that's when he decided that yes, he was going to sit under this tree until he gained enlightenment. But of course his five fellow practitioners of extreme asceticism thought that he'd wimped out. They basically thought that he couldn't handle it and had taken some sort of path of luxury. They accused him of reverting to luxury because he'd had some rice milk. And they abandoned him in disgust. They felt let down, they felt betrayed. Here was their leader who was now eating. So they abandoned him and went their way. And of course we've heard that the Buddha did succeed on that full moon night in what we call May. He did succeed in liberating his mind from all the fetters, all the shackles that human beings are heir to. And he became a Buddha. He almost, well, as Subhadramati said, it's almost like he became another species. At least in terms of his consciousness, he transcended the human condition, although his body was still human. He sits under the Bodhi tree for a long time. He sits under it, absorbing his enlightenment experience. And then for 7 weeks, he sits in the vicinity of the Bodhi tree, yes, just coming to terms with what had happened to him. Those 7 weeks are, well, they could fill 7 talks in themselves. For example, for 1 whole week, he gazes at the tree in gratitude for having sheltered him, for having been part of the conditions that led to his liberation. There's so much gratitude that the tree becomes sacred and an object of reverence. But anyway, after 7 weeks, he was looking, he'd absorbed his experience to some degree, and he wanted to communicate it to other people. He wanted to communicate it. There's this urge in the enlightened mind. It's not just that he wanted to communicate it. There's this compulsion in the enlightened mind to communicate the experience. The enlightened experience is said to be without a sense of division between self and other. So there's this sort of pressure on the enlightened mind, if the enlightened mind can feel any pressure, which it probably can't. There's this sort of compulsion to communicate. And in a certain sense, the enlightenment of the Buddha isn't complete until he has communicated, in a certain sense. And I'm speaking as if, and in a certain sense, I don't know what I'm talking about. So, he looked around. It said that he looked around with his divine eye, and he saw that those 5 former practitioners, his companions, were living in a deer park called Isipatana, in what's now called Sarnath, on the borders of Varanasi. And he saw that they were there, and he realized that they may be able to understand what he'd realized. He felt that there was a chance that he could communicate his experience to them. So he sets out on foot to Sarnath, and eventually he arrives, and they see him coming from a distance, and they all sort of confer amongst themselves and say, there's Siddhartha Gautama, the one who reverted to luxury. Let's ignore him. Let's not acknowledge him. He's a charlatan. He doesn't deserve our acknowledgement. And the Buddha, of course, just carries on walking to them. and something happens. His presence, perhaps his radiance, his very being, communicates something, and they feel compelled to rise from their seats and to greet him and prepare a seat for him and welcome him back into their midst. It's like they can't help it despite themselves. And he says to them, friends, the deathless has been attained. The deathless has been attained. And they say, no, we don't believe you. You didn't attain anything when you were practicing all these practices mortifying the flesh. Now that you're eating and living this luxurious, indulgent life, you say that you've attained the deathless. We don't believe you. And he said, friends, have you ever seen me like this before? Have you ever heard me make any claims before? And they say, well, no. So he says, the deathless has been attained. Let me teach you what I've seen. And then the texts don't really say what the Buddha taught them. Later texts say that he taught them the Four Noble Truths, including the Eightfold Path, and the truth of, that suffering exists and the way that leads out of suffering. Later texts say that, but actually it's very unlikely that he said that. Buddhism became codified because people needed to memorize the teachings. But the Buddha probably didn't talk in terms of lists. He probably didn't say there were four truths, they're noble, the first one is. He didn't talk like that. His experience was just trying to make sense of... he was trying to make sense of his experience and articulate it as best he could. Enlightenment is beyond all concepts, all words, and yet he was trying to find words that could communicate something that, in a certain sense, is beyond, all language, all reason. So he probably didn't say the Four Noble Truths. I'm going to come back to, later on in the talk, I'm probably going to come back to, well, I will come back to, what he might have said. But for now, I'm jumping ahead to say that one of those five suddenly realized. He woke up. He realized he had the same realization that the Buddha did. He was called Kundanya. And the Buddha is said to exclaim with a sigh that I think has joy and exhilaration in it. He's said to exclaim, Kundanya knows. Kundanya knows. And that's all the text says. And you have to read into it all the exhilaration, all the relief and the joy that that moment must have possessed. And what the scriptures say is that, well, again, the universe shook. The whole cosmos vibrated. Because not only had you now enlightenment in human form, you had an enlightened being, but that enlightenment had been communicated. The wheel of the Dharma had been set in motion. And it said that nobody would ever be able to turn that wheel back, stop that wheel from turning. So something of unimaginable significance for all beings everywhere had occurred at that moment when Kundanya had that realization. It turns out that all the other four also, in time, gained enlightenment. So then there were six enlightened beings in the world. And yes, if I carried on, I'd talk about other enlightened beings that arose, but I'm not going to tell you about those in this talk. What I want to do is just examine this happening of the first turning of the wheel. And I just want to draw out some points from it. So the first point I want to draw out is about the ascetics, and the Buddha-to-be when he was practicing asceticism, when he was trying to gain realization through starving himself in other disciplines. Yes, that was the wrong turning. Yes, it didn't lead anywhere, and could have been disastrous had he just died. But then, on the other hand, there's something really admirable about those people striving so fully for the truth. The effort, the energy, the sheer determination and stamina and will that people exhibited, and some people, I believe, in India probably still do, well, elsewhere as well, is something that I really admire. I'm not so hot on striving. Even by our luxurious Western standards, I do like my desserts and cake and... I mean, that banana today. Yeah, it was good. So I do admire, or at least partly admire, that people can be so single-minded as to be willing to die for the truth, for liberation. There's also something admirable about the willingness to give up everything. The renunciation, the simplicity is... I find slightly challenging, inspiring and slightly daunting. Every year, well, I come to Sibford most years, I have been coming for the last 17 years, most years, and every year I think, oh, not those little beds and those little sinks and those cold shrine rooms and those overheated rooms and not all of that. couldn't we do it somewhere... Well, I've done retreats in Italy, in Umbria, in this summer sun, in the Umbrian hills, and, really, really beautiful place, and I kind of yearn for... I'm really happy on retreats, actually, I'm at my happiest on retreats, but I do like Umbria, as it were. So anyway, there's something to be admired about that renunciative spirit. And in a sense, we have renounced, haven't we, all of us, for the last 5, 10 days or whatever. We have simplified our lives to some degree. And I think we've experienced some of the fruits of that simplification. At least I have. A stiller, quieter mind. A more uplifted mind, even a sense of energy. That comes from not distracting ourselves with all the things that we normally do, and a perspective that comes from that. So yes, what I want to just point out is, although it was a wrong turning, the renunciative ideal is very important in Buddhism, and we are a long, long way from the sort of mortification of the flesh that the ascetics were doing. And there's probably a long way for all of us, I include myself, to go in terms of trying to simplify our lives. We could do a lot more. And if we had the courage to do that, I think our lives could be richer, not poorer. But one of the things the ascetics didn't seem to have very much of is a sense of enjoyment that was healthy. A sense of pleasure that was healthy. They seemed to think that all pleasure was unhelpful in the spiritual life. And the Buddha realized that just wasn't true. That pleasure is not somehow bad. It's not always unhelpful. There are pleasures that we can have that actually open us up, open the heart. Meditation can be very, very pleasurable. I mean, it can also not be, but it can be very, very pleasurable. Enjoying nature, beauty, the arts can be very, very pleasurable. We can learn to play in a more and more skillful way. And I think that this is really, really, really important if we're going to try and practice Buddhism. It's so easy to become over-earnest and think that Buddhism has to be serious, and it's all sort of life-denying, and actually it's far, far from it. It's life-enhancing. It's just saying, look for the pleasures that really enhance you. look for those pleasures, cultivate them. And I think that's really, really important on this retreat. We've been trying to do that in some ways. I think that it is lovely that we have bananas and for dessert. We could have chosen just to have brown rice and water, and you would have survived. But we've chosen actually to have simple but delicious, healthy food. We've chosen to try and create something beautiful in this room, try and appreciate the natural beauty around us. We've created a community amongst ourselves, which is extremely rich and satisfying and pleasurable. There's been a lot of laughter, even in the silence. There's been joy. And I think this is as important as the renunciation. Both are needed. Both are needed. One without the other just doesn't work. One without the other doesn't work. A sense of humour, you need a sense of humour if you're going to go deeper into yourself and face the darker, less congenial aspects of yourself. If you're not going to fall into the sort of neurotic guilt that Subhadramati was warning against, then one way of avoiding that is to not take yourself too seriously. Yeah? We're none of us perfect, and we're none of us ogres. We're just human, and that's all right. And we can sort of laugh at our foibles. We all get ourselves into silly little messes, don't we? So yes, the renunciation and the play and the joy. The next thing I want to say is that when the five ascetics left the Buddha, he was left alone. He was left alone. And it seems to me significant that he became enlightened on his own. At least it seems significant from a symbolic level. Because, yes, we've got Sangha, yes, we've got community, and that is vital for most of us, for all of us probably, unless we've got the spiritual aptitude of Siddhartha Gautama. And yet, the spiritual journey is something that we tread alone. It happens in our own minds and our own hearts. Nobody can do it for us. I or Subhadramati can urge you to meditate and do the program. But even if you were to come to the shrine room, I can't sort of get inside your mind and make you still, or make you content, or make you have a larger vision of what it is to be human. We have to do that ourselves. Nobody can do it for us. There's an aloneness to this. Allied to this is, essential to Buddhism is this teaching that we have to take responsibility for our own minds. We have to take responsibility for our own responses to what happens. Of course, we can't control everything that happens to us. Sometimes horrendous things happen to us, and it's not our fault. But nevertheless, our response is ours. Buddhism has no sort of shades of grey in this. It says that we completely, 100% completely, are responsible for every response in our mind. All the time, regardless. That means there's no room in Buddhism for blame. That includes blaming ourselves. Because blaming ourselves just gets into the sort of guilt that we're trying to avoid. But there's no room also for blaming others. There's no room for blaming circumstances. There's only our response. Yes, there's an acknowledgement that suffering exists, that life doesn't always work out. In fact, in the end, it doesn't work out. And there's a complete responsibility for our lives, for our mind. I think this is one of the most challenging things that Buddhism teaches us. I find it very, very difficult to really, really take this on board, that I am completely responsible for my responses. And it also, I think, challenges our culture, where, and I'm generalising wildly here, so, you know, forgive the generalisation, but our culture can be a culture of blame. It can be a culture where we justify our responses either through looking at what happened in our lives or blaming the world around us or blaming other people, politicians, whatever. It's so easy to fall into that culture of blame. I was very struck by an order member who lives in India. He's an Indian order member. He happened to be over in the West earlier this year. I won't say his name, but I'm going to tell his story. I was asking him, in a way, just about himself, what his background was. And he was born into the ex-untouchable community, the Dalit community, the poorest and the most oppressed people in India, possibly amongst the most poorest and oppressed people on the planet. And he was born into that Hindu, it's not even a caste, it's below caste, but in that oppressive caste system, which is sort of bad enough to scar somebody for life. But when he was young, I don't know how old, but he was a boy, his father committed suicide. His father committed suicide. So that, you think, is sort of horrendous enough and scars somebody for life. He was living, as people do in India, in an extended family. So his father's parents, his grandparents, uncles, aunts, etc. And in that family, they blamed his mother for his father's death. They blamed her and drove her out of the house. He was still a boy. They kept him, but drove her out and told him that she'd left, that she'd abandoned him. He was so young as to not know any different and was brought up in this family. And unbeknownst to him, his mother was trying to see him. Apparently she would try and see him at the school gates and but somehow she was prevented from having any contact with him. He found out the truth of what had happened only as an adult and found out that by then his mother had died. And he was telling this story, which I found sort of both sort of heart-rending and almost unimaginable. And then he said he gets on quite well with his family, the family who brought him up. He feels quite fondly for them. He said they were kind to him after all. They brought him up. And he says, besides, they were ignorant. They didn't have the Dharma, he said. They didn't know about the Dharma. They were just doing their best. And it's that that really moved me. It's that that really moved me. How incredible that somebody could, as an adult, quite happily, in an integrated, split off kind of way, say, that's all right, that happens. They did their best, I forgive them. They didn't have the Dharma, I'm the fortunate one, I've got the Dharma. So I wanted to tell that because I think it's a supreme example of somebody taking responsibility for their own minds, their own responses, their own lives. I think in the West we're so used to having high expectations of what life should provide us with. We live with this illusion of the perfect family on the back of the cereal packet. And if our parents, if our siblings, if our children don't live up to that ideal, we feel betrayed by life. How silly. How silly to believe in the cereal packet in the first place. Okay, so I'm going to move on from that point about the Buddha to be taking full responsibility for his mind. Then I want to just touch on, the Buddha as he now is, approaching these five disciples or people who had practiced with him, and them opening up to him almost despite themselves. Them suddenly being willing to hear what he had to say and to learn from him. And they, in the story, for me, are an example of spiritual receptivity, a willingness to say, okay, maybe I don't know it all. Maybe there is something for me to learn. Maybe there's something even higher than me. And again, I think this is a real challenge for us. Again and again on this retreat, we've been presenting you with a challenge. It's represented on this shrine, but it's represented also in all, well, so many ways of being on retreat. We've been presenting you with a challenge that says there is something more. There is something higher. There is something greater than us. Something that we can revere, something that we can aspire to, something that we can move towards, something that we can become, that is worth living for, worth striving for. It's the vertical dimension in life. It's the vertical dimension that is so often missing, again, in our 21st century postmodern, super sophisticated culture that says, at its extreme, it says, no value system is any higher than any other value system. Whatever works for you is fine. Whatever works for me is fine. And we can't compare. And we can't judge, because to judge would be to be judgmental. And I can see why we've arrived at that position, because value systems and ideals have turned into ideologies that have been oppressive. We've suffered. Perhaps ourselves, but certainly the world has suffered against under oppressive ideologies. The 20th century is littered with the suffering of oppressive ideologies. So we are sceptical of ideals, because they can so easily turn into dogma that is then used to repress and punish and inflict suffering on others. Yes, we're right, I think, to be wary of ideologies and dogma. But surely we're intelligent enough to not throw away ideals, human ideals, ideals such as kindness and generosity and love and awareness and wisdom and energy and fearlessness are human ideals. They're not invented by the Buddha. They're there in reality. They're human ideals, and we're very, very silly if we ignore them and throw them away. The other point that I want to make about receptivity is, in a way, it's worse than that, because we, not only have we so easily thrown away all ideals, we think we know best. At least if we're thrown away all ideals and then realise that, well, we're a bit lost, that would help. But somehow, a lot of the time, we think as a culture that we know best. We pat ourselves on the back for being really, really clever. Because we invent all these gadgets and we have all these, That's what we have, isn't it? And we think that we're really, really clever as a culture. And we think we know it all. We're really, really clever with words. And we're not really willing to admit that we're lost. I find that, at times, I find it shocking. How closed we can become. But perhaps it's not just us. There's a story from the Zen tradition, and presumably the story goes back centuries, of a man going to a Zen master to ask for a teaching. And the Zen master, as Zen masters are wont to do, doesn't reply. Instead, he calls for some tea. It's probably green tea and a beautiful Japanese cup. Some of us had a tea ceremony the other day, I won't go into it. The Zen master looks at the man and starts pouring tea into this cup. And the man thinks, oh, that's nice. We're going to have a chat and a teaching over tea. Perhaps that's what he thinks, anyway. But the master just keeps pouring the tea, and the cup fills up, and it's full to the brim. But he just keeps pouring more tea, and it's overflowing, and it's going all over the table, and he just keeps pouring more and more tea into this cup. And the man says, "Are you mad? What are you doing?" And the Zen master says, "How can I give you a teaching? Your mind is like this cup. It's already full. It's already full and overflowing. There's no more room for any more teaching." And that is, I think, our condition very often. We're already full to overflowing. And so very often we want to hear the Dharma, but we're not willing to empty our minds. We're not willing to learn to, in a way, become receptive and acknowledge that we may not know what's best. As well as an overfull cup, sometimes our cups are cracked. They're leaky. So you pour the tea in and it just leaks out the bottom. So it seems to be an empty cup, but nothing stays in. Nothing stays in. So you can hear the same teaching hundreds of times and it doesn't go in. I don't know if this is your experience. It has been my experience. It feels like nothing sort of stays. Or it's said that our cups can contain a tiny bit of poison in them, so that everything that is poured into it becomes poisonous. Even something true becomes perverted. And the poison that we so easily have in our minds is cynicism. Cynicism is poisonous. It's so easy to become cynical about any ideal. Somebody is generous to us and we immediately assume they want something from us. Somebody is just friendly and we think, oh, they're trying to ingratiate themselves. There's such a lot of cynicism in our culture, and it poisons our mind. The Dharma can't be practiced as long as there's cynicism in our mind. Okay, I need to move on. So what did the Buddha teach those five people? What did he say to Kundanya that so awoke him? We don't know. The texts don't tell us. But I suspect that he talked about the need for kindness. Because these ascetics, remember, had been practicing very, very hard. They knew about the truth of suffering. They knew that life was unsatisfactory. But they didn't seem to have, at least in their practices towards themselves, a sense of metta. So I suspect he must have talked about kindness. I suspect he must have talked about having skillful intentions, a positive mind. And I suspect he would have said, you don't need to inflict any more suffering on yourself. Just observe your experience as it is. Just observe your experience without rejecting anything or without clinging to anything. Just notice what's going on as acutely as you can. And notice when you do that, that there's nothing fixed in your experience. There's nothing fixed. There's nothing unchanging, even for a moment. And notice the implications of that. That means that you don't exist as an entity. You don't exist as an entity, in the sense of an entity being a fixed, separate thing. You are just a river of energy that happens to have constellated in this form for a while. Of course he wouldn't have used those words, but I think he would have tried to express something of those truths. And then he would have said, let go. So if there's nothing fixed about you, there's nothing to hold on to. In fact, as soon as we realise, if we have a realisation that we're just flowing, that we're just process, then the letting go happens of its own accord. Letting go happens when we realise that there isn't a real thing called called Nyanavacha, or called Rebecca, or called Subhadramati. That's just a name, a convenient label. Letting go happens at the deepest level. And for Kundanya, it really happened. And that letting go is a kind of death. It's a kind of death. It's a spiritual death, rather than a physical death. But it's linked to physical death, in that it feels like you're going to die. Because you let go of everything known about you. Not just a job, and not just the body, not just luxury goods, not just even your views. You let go at a visceral level, in your guts, of the very, very urge to survive, the very urge to exist, the very urge to live as a separate entity. You surrender that. And when you do, something enormous and magical happens. But I'll come on to that. So yes, letting go is the teaching of the Buddha. And that means letting go of who we think we are, our sort of personas. It means letting go of what we think we know, all our views and ideas about life, about ourselves. It means letting go of what we think we want, what we think will make us happy. So there's no more challenging thing than letting go in life while still alive. At some point, we'll all have to let go when death arrives, physical death. Death is the point where we'll all have to let go of all of those things. But Buddhism's saying you can die in life. And if you die while still alive, spiritually die, then you really live. Because then you become free and fearless and still and full of love. And it's not even your love, it's not your metta, it's that metta rushes through you. Life rushes through you, and there are no obstacles that you put in the way. And that is the only security. That is the only security. And if we could realize that, then death, physical death, has no relevance. There's nothing to fear, because we've already let go. We've already let go. So losing the body is nothing. So I think this is one of the hardest things to even get our heads around, let alone try and do. And in order to do it, in order to even approach it, we need to build confidence that if we let go, to whatever degree, that it's not going to be into a void, it's not going to be a black nothingness that we let go into. We need to have confidence that there's something positive that will come through us, that we will experience, if we dare to just surrender our grip a little. For what is it to die but to stand in the sun and melt into the wind? That's Khalil Gibran in The Prophet. Okay, I'm going to move on to, in a way, try and evoke what it might be that arises when we let go. So this is spiritual rebirth. And Virochana is, in a way, what arises when we let go. When we willingly surrender, Virochana is what arises. In a way, all these Buddhas are what arise. But Virochana is perhaps the epitome of what arises. Our consciousness expands. Because when we hold on to ourselves, when we identify with this physical form, our consciousness is narrowed by it. When we cease to identify with anything about us, consciousness becomes unbounded. It's limitless. already it's more spacious than you think. So when you sit down to meditate, you don't feel as if you're trapped in your skull, do you? You have a sense of more space than that. Well, that's an indication that consciousness is in another dimension that isn't limited by this three-dimensional space. It can expand infinitely. So we have a bigger perspective. We have a bigger perspective. It's analogous in a way to having a cosmic perspective. If we could really see the Earth and our lives from the cosmos, we wouldn't be so concerned about all the petty things that we get concerned about. Do they like me? Which sort of so concerns us somewhere, doesn't it? That really would seem not so big a deal. There's this lovely photograph that's been taken by one of the probes that goes out to Jupiter and things. When they were sending it out, at the edge of the solar system, they got it to turn around somehow and take a photo of the Earth. And the Earth appears. There's this trick of light, and there's this... it's like this ray of sunlight. Well, it is a ray of the sun. And in that ray of the sun, this tiny beam, there's a tiny, tiny blue dot that you can just make out in the photograph, and that's the Earth. And that's the furthest that the Earth has been photographed from. And Carl Sagan has this to say about that photograph. He says, consider again that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. The aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, every hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every teacher, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there. On a mote of dust, suspended in a sunbeam. Isn't that beautiful? And that perspective is that's not the perspective of enlightenment, but it gives us a glimpse of what a wider perspective might look like. If we could see ourselves from the outside, I think we would live a saner, healthier life. Virochana is the sun. His symbol is the sun. He is an image of the sun at the center of the universe. He is the embodiment of infinite space. But infinite space not in the literal sense of this cosmic perspective, because that cosmic perspective exists out there in three dimensions. But Virochana is infinite space internal. It's another dimension. It's infinite consciousness. It's infinite spaciousness and freedom of being. But it's even more mysterious than that. In a later Buddhist text, there's a pilgrim called Sudana who he goes on a pilgrimage, and at the end of his pilgrimage, quest for truth, he's let into this beautiful tower. This tower, which is ornamented with jewels and banners and lights and incense, and is round and beautiful, and he's given entry into this tower, and he walks inside, and inside there's infinite space, and inside the tower there are an infinite number of other towers, all like the one that he's standing in, all of them containing an infinite number of towers. That is more like the perspective of enlightenment. It defies any conceptual grasp. It's something beyond even that sort of cosmic perspective or any notion of infinity. It's mysterious. Rilke says, we will see everything and ourselves in everything, healed and whole forever. And Buddhism would add that not only will we see everything and ourselves in everything, but we will see everything in ourselves. Everything in ourselves. We contain the whole universe, in a sense. But even that's not enough. Even that's not enough, because from a Buddhist perspective, it's not just that the universe is somehow vast and magnificent and interpenetrating in this way, but it's alive. The universe is somehow alive. It's more of the nature of consciousness than it is of inert matter. It's somehow vibrant and aware. And this, again, is Virochana. Virochana is somehow aware of us. Or it's as if he is aware of us. It's as if reality, Virochana, is always turning the wheel of the Dharma, always trying to teach us, always trying to wake us up. We don't always listen, we don't always learn, but that is what is happening to us all the time. And when we don't listen and when we don't learn, we experience the teaching of impermanence as painful. If we could listen and learn, we would experience it as liberating. But the Buddha, Virochana, Shakyamuni Buddha, is always, reality is always reaching down, just as we reach up, and that is the compassion of the Buddha. He's white because he contains all the other colours, and the whiteness is so dazzling that we would be burnt to a crisp if we could really see it. He contains all the other qualities of all the Buddhas as refracted light displays all the colours. So all the wisdom, the generosity, the abundance, the love, the fearlessness is, it's displayed in Virochana's crown. He has the crown of all the Buddhas. So yes, I'm just going to conclude now. In fact, no, let me read you a little poem by Rumi first. Rumi talks, doesn't he, in his poetry, very much of self-surrender, surrendering to the divine. And in this poem, the divine is, the analogy is the sun, and he himself is a piece of laundry being washed on the banks of the river. Seizing my life in your hands, you thrashed me clean on the savage rocks of eternal mind. How its colours bled until they grew white. You smile and sit back. I dry in your sun. Isn't that lovely? I really like this savage rocks of eternal mind. I know it's not everybody's cup of tea, but I love it. So yes, just to conclude, just to say that this story of the turning of the wheel, I think, contains a paradigm for the whole of our spiritual lives. If we can simplify our lives, if we can make an effort, if we can learn to focus on what's really important in our lives, if we can do that with the spirit of play, of not losing a sense of humour, of not shunning pleasure as if it were sinful, if we can take responsibility for our own minds at all times, in all situations, if we can be receptive to the vertical dimension in the universe, receptive to ideals without falling into ideology, if we can learn to let go of ego clinging, if we can be willing to die, then we will be touched by something beyond all description. Something that is personified by Virochana. We'll look into the face of the sun. will enter into his towers of the infinite, will enter into a mystery that transcends all ways of knowing. It will be as if we have woken up from a painful dream and will know ourselves for the first time. Thank you.